Today's program has been brought to you by Seersucker, located at 329 Smith Street in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. For more information, visit www.seersuckerbrooklyn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 57, The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. It's a balmy day here in at Roberta's in Bushwick.
A balm in Gilead.
It feels like spring.
It does feel like spring.
In January.
I was listening to some Stravinsky this morning while putting on my mascara. Felt very springy.
I really wish I knew that classical music reference and I could respond with something witty, but...
It doesn't matter. It's a lot of strings.
I'm assuming string and spring rhyme, and that's where you got that.
How are you, Jesse Kiefer?
I'm doing well. Jen, you've really hit a milestone this week, right? You have a huge announcement to make.
I have hit a milestone. I'm going to color my hair for the first time. I'm kidding. I'm not. I would never do that. But I have decided to make my triumphant exit from the restaurant industry this month, which has been a long time coming. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Joe. It has been a long and bumpy, very wine-drenched road. But it's time to go pursue other ventures. But I was thinking about that this week and how appropriate it was that we were discussing this on our show, which talks about the restaurant industry, my beloved home, for years. And I was thinking about how I got started in this world and my humble beginnings. And so I wanted to write a story for that favorite segment of ours, Front of House.
It's your favorite story. It's front of house. How sassy.
So if I may, I'd like to bring the dame in, as usual, the Baroness Olivier, to read this piece for us. Dame?
As I make my clunky, graceless exit from the front of house world, it seems only appropriate that today's feature visit the day I began. Though the hot-blooded, buzzing world of New York restaurants is for the most part populated and conducted by the young, I found my way there by working for the very, very old. In 2002, after a series of shitty part-time jobs that had not ended well, after hostessing at Olive Garden for 2 months, I had managed to offend a blind man, trip a child, and start a small fire. My parents decided it was time for me to get back on the old horse. "Why don't you try waiting tables," my dad had said, as though waiting tables was like trying jogging or Greek yogurt for the first time. I glared at him, as only 17-year-olds can, and I said, "I don't think so. You see, after college I was going to move to New York City to be an actress, so I wouldn't have time for this puerile waiting tables nonsense. Not for me." My father had little patience for my attitude and reminded me that soon I'd have a mile-high stack of student loans to pay off, so I'd better get to it whether I liked it or not. 2 weeks later, after a classmate tipped me off on a gig, as she put it, which was the first time I realized that calling a job a gig made it feel less permanent and way more legit. My gig was as a server at Marriott's Forum at Brookside, a retirement community for the aging Kentucky elite. The campus boasted a golf course, elaborate dining hall, and pool, though it had recently been closed for investigation after Mrs. Fitzpatrick had driven her scooty into it during an afternoon water aerobics class. I couldn't know this at the time, but the scooty would become a primary figure in my experience at the Forum. For now, I was given an oversized tuxedo shirt and clip-on bow tie and told to trail Michelle. Michelle had worked at the Forum for 2 years, which in high school time meant she was nearing retirement. She glided through the dining room with Hepburnian ease, kissing Mr. Mills on the cheek before dropping Mrs. Rubinson's cheesecake and refilling her coffee at the same time. The residents loved her, and I was later told had given her enough Christmas money that year to pay off her Jeep. This place was amazing. Dinner was served at 5, over at 7, and I got to eat all the angel food cake my heart desired. And so I followed Michelle's brazen lead, and soon myself became a favorite in the Forum dining room. For those on our staff not anointed with the gift of charm, there was a different job that required less effort. At the entrance of the dining room was a sign that read, "Valet Parking Here." I remember seeing the sign for the first time and coyly asking a co-worker, "Why is that inside?" Oh, it's for the scooters, she'd said. Stupid gin. It's for the scooters, of course. That Marriott's forum at Brookside allowed a staff of teenage boys to valet park dozens of scooters every night seemed a bit reckless to me, but the boys pulled it off without incident for the first few months of my time there. The first and perhaps most infamous incident, of course, involved me. 2 months in, and already restless, I pulled my co-worker Anthony to the side. Anthony, a round-faced boy with a musical twang, assured me it would be cool if we switched jobs for the night. The manager had been out of town, and the assistant manager on duty was all but brain-dead. Okay, I said. Anything I should know? Nope, just the two speeds, said Anthony. The two speeds of which he spoke were indicated by two icons and a dial by the handlebars, a turtle and a rabbit. And so I began my first and last valet shift, putting through the halls to the maintenance closet where the scooters were kept. I'd been driving at a steady turtle for the whole of the afternoon, and decided it was time to see what this bad boy could really do. As I rounded a corner, towards my last stretch of hallway, I cranked the dial to rabbit. My head was thrown back, and I was shocked at how much speed this little thing could actually get. The wind in my hair and my widened eyes fixed on my destination, I careened down the empty hall. Fate is a tricky figurine, and that day she had decided that my time at the forum was over. For as I approached the maintenance room, wheels spinning wildly, out of an unseen door shuffled Mrs. Borellis. She froze in terror, seeing now that our paths were doomed to cross. I, instead of braking like a normal person, twisted the handlebars to the side to avoid her, throwing me off of the scooter and on to poor Mrs. Borellis. As I lay atop of Gert, I felt that now was as good a time as ever to switch to a first-name basis. I glanced up at the tiled ceiling and I thought, I wonder what the future holds for someone like me. 10 years and 3,000 restaurant disasters later, I now know that the job isn't the thing. Just like my joyride on the scooty that day, life is what you make of it, each shitty and wonderful job included. I'm 10 years older, and I do live in New York City, and I am sure an actress, sort of. But as I move from this chapter in my life, I know, just as I knew lying atop Mrs. Borellis that day, that there are still many beautiful, terrible crashes to come. And so I thank you. I thank you. Adieu.
The dame has already scooted out.
She's gone. As quickly as she came.
I was, you know, when she was reading that, I was thinking she must feel super comfortable on one of those scooters.
Oh, she has about four in various colors, matching her different outfits.
Well, much like Jen leaving her server life to pursue other endeavors, we have two women in studio who have already jumped into the abyss. I don't want to get all Spice Girls on it, but it's a real girl power show.
Oh.
That was my ginger spice. I'm glad you did the accents on the show. Just barely. In studio, Georgia Pellegrini. She's the woman who ditched her 9-to-5 for a cast iron and a shotgun. She's an author, chef, and a girl hunter. Georgia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Also in studio today, one of the most interesting, charismatic, and French women in the wine world.
Salut.
Camille Riviere. I knew I was going to do that every single time. There's a name that
you
I'm
had
like,
it the second
I pronounced
time.
It.
You
I
had
know.
It. It
well,
beautiful.
I've even phonetically spelled it. Well, bienvenue.
Merci beaucoup, Jessie. Merci de m'avoir invité.
Well, I can't wait to talk to you both. We're going to take a break. Be right back on The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on the heritageradionetwork.org. This one goes out to Jen Tollett.
I'm
we'd like to send a special thank you to our latest business member, Seersucker. Seersucker is a 40-seat neighborhood spot inspired by the food and hospitality of the South. Chef-owner Robert Newton, who hails from Arkansas, has crafted a cuisine inspired equally by his childhood favorites and the Carroll Street Green Market across the street. He relies upon small local farms and indie purveyors for many of his ingredients, so the menu changes frequently based on what's available and in season. Seersucker's beer, wine, and spirits list is all-American, with an emphasis on New York State. Learn more by visiting their website, seersuckerbrooklyn.com.
To learn more about becoming a business member, email us, info@heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to The Morning After. After ditching the Wall Street world to enroll in the French Culinary Institute, she has worked in some of the best kitchens in New York City and France. She's the author of two books, Food Heroes and Girl Hunter, revolutionizing the way we eat one hunt at a time. Georgia Pellegrini, welcome to the show. She is unarmed. Do you feel naked without your shotgun?
A little bit, yeah.
I always feel naked without my glasses.
Especially going through, you know, Brooklyn.
It's not that
land
rough,
of shotguns.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I can only imagine that after leaving the Wall Street world, you would have to get a gun.
Yeah.
Well, so you grew up upstate, kind of an outdoorsy life.
I did.
And then you ended up going to prep school in New York City, and that kind of led you into the Wall Street world. What was the moment that kind of made you come back to your roots?
I definitely had a watershed moment when I was working at a restaurant called Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and I had grown up fishing my trout for breakfast, and I had chickens and honeybees growing up, and definitely living off the land. I had a great aunt who knew the name of every single plant on earth, and it was this amazing lost art, basically. So I definitely had that in my blood, and I started working at a restaurant outside the city. And as part of working at that restaurant, we had to really have a hands-on approach to our ingredients. And one of those things was killing the turkeys for the restaurant. And that was probably the watershed moment when I realized, I don't just want to butcher. I don't just want to fillet. I want to really start from the very beginning, pay the full karmic price of the meal, so to speak, and really understand what has to happen for food to get to the plate. So I decided I wanted to learn how to hunt.
And yeah, in checking out your book, Girl Hunter, like I noticed that you seem to be so much more interested in the specific ingredients that go into a dish as opposed to the whole dish itself, and that would, you know, correlate to the wanting to hunt. How often do you go hunting?
It depends on the season, but I go in the actual high season several times a month, and then it sort of tapers off in the summer times. I'll fish. For me, though, you know, I garden a lot as well, and for me, like you're saying, it's about really having an intuitive connection to your ingredients. And with wild animals, it's a real challenge, especially as a chef. You know, when we get meat from a feedlot or just sort of that standard beef and chicken, it all sort of tastes the same because they're fed the same things over and over. And with wild animals, they're athletes. They run freely. They eat whatever they want to eat. And so I always think that each piece of meat now is a grand culinary adventure. You know, it's going to be a new experience each time. So you think about, what was it eating, and how am I going to sort of cook it as a result of what it was eating? And then, you know, it's sort of this whole cycle that you have to think about as a result.
What are the different ways to combat that? I remember I was reading a recipe about, you know, with wild duck, you have to make sure if they're being fed fish, or if they're eating fish, or if they're eating a kind of more grain heavy diet, right?
Sure.
And how do you as a chef and going into that determine those things, and what are the different ways that you approach them?
So wild animals, or all animals, actually carry their flavor in their fat. Wild animals carry it all in a layer above it, whereas domestic animals tend to have marbling in their flesh. So you can actually just render a piece of the fat and taste it and see, is it taste fishy? Was it a deep diving duck? Did it have a lot of fish in its diet? And the way I combat that is usually a brine, which is a saltwater solution with flavoring elements in there that usually helps draw the moisture in and sort of, you know, takes away a lot of that really potent gaminess or fishiness. Or I also cure a lot of my meat. I think it's a great way of preserving meat. Even when you buy it, you know, and if you find a great piece of meat, but you're not going to be able to eat it all, I love to cure it rather than freeze it often. It's a great way of sort of making it last.
What does that process entail for you?
The curing of it?
Yeah.
It's sort of a similar thing. Salt is your best friend with a lot of meat in general, whether it's brining or curing and drying it. I do a lot of jerky, which is dehydration. It's a great fun thing just to bring on the subway with you when you're hungry.
Yep. Absolutely.
And now as you're you're even closer to your ingredients, and you, you know, you're killing the animals yourself. Do you, do you feel that you're actually eating more meat than you were before you had kind of had this revelation about wanting to hunt?
I think I'm actually eating less meat. But I think the meat that I eat is a lot more satisfying to me. Wild meat is actually a lot denser. It's a lot richer. And so you're satisfied, from less of it. And, you know, I realized that for me, it's I don't need as much meat. I think Americans have this idea that they need to have a big steak with every meal, a huge steak. And you really don't. You know, it's about sort of just having a more conscious relationship with your ingredients. And when you have a hand in them, it's a much more meaningful meal.
And do you kind of focus other ingredients that you would incorporate into the meat dish to kind of correlate to where you caught the animal?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I get kind of playful with it. People tease me because I eat squirrel a lot, and
I love squirrel.
It's so delicious. Love squirrel. Best meat in the woods.
I'm from Kentucky, so I got you right here, girl.
Kentucky is the squirrel capital of this country, actually.
Really? I am aware.
They closed school on opening day of squirrel season in Kentucky. Yeah. Amen, sister.
That was a high five for squirrel hunting season.
And, you know, I mean, sometimes I'll do like a squirrel Brunswick stew and I'll put acorns in there just to be kitschy. But, you know, it's a wonderful meat and more people need to do it. People in New York are afraid of squirrel. I think they're like tree rats or that hang out on the fire escape. But, you know, you are what you eat. So think about what it's been eating. And squirrels are nutty and sweet because they love acorns and pecans. So amen to the squirrel.
I've never had
squirrel power.
Well, I know what's yes. on the to-do list for this month, Miss Keeper.
Well, where can we eat squirrel in New York City, do you think? Aside from
I wouldn't Tompkins recommend getting it from your fire escape because who knows what it's been eating.
Exactly.
But, you know, I would find a friend maybe that has some woods in their midst. I wouldn't take out the shotgun in Washington Square Park or Central Park.
Mostly for the arresting aspect.
Yeah, you might have some issues.
Do you shoot a squirrel with a shotgun?
Or a small .22. I mean, it depends on the scenario, but it would need to be a smaller shotgun.
So there's a natural correlation between guns and violence and
sure.
hunting and violence. Have you gotten any feedback now that, cause you're an outspoken hunting advocate.
Sure.
And, you know, while I believe that you are practicing everything very ethically,
sure.
you know, what kind of feedback have you gotten, positive or negative?
I think that, you know, there is this, I think the topic of guns is a very charged thing. And I view guns as a tool the same way I do a knife or a hammer. And in fact, I've hunted with just a knife before because I think, you know, a gun is a bit of a cop-out. You know, our ancestors didn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely make things more efficient and also allow for a cleaner kill, less suffering, which is important. But obviously, they're a highly charged thing. I think we need to demystify them a little bit and realize that if we understand what they are, what they're supposed to be used for, and how to use them responsibly and safely, I think it maybe would have a better, you know, PR mm-hmm. status. But it's true. I mean, especially in cities, it's, you know, they're not as easy to come by. And so people have a harder time knowing how to have a relationship with them that's safe.
Oh, absolutely. And you market yourself as the girl hunter. Do you feel like women approach hunting differently than men do?
They do. You know, the name of my book was Girl Hunter, and it's sort of, that phrase has sort of taken off on its own. Mm-hmm. And I think what's been interesting for me is, you know, the way that men hunt and the way that women hunt is very different. When I started to learn, I was really hunting with mostly men, but I've started to have these women adventure weekends just almost by accident. Women started contacting me and saying, you know, I don't really want to go hunting with my husband and his friends. They're weird and they freak me out. I want to go hunting with a woman who I can relate to more. And so it sort of started to happen that way, where I take these groups of women out. And it's sort of an amazing experience because women are much more patient, they're more intuitive, they're much, you know, they often are the home cooks. And so it's wonderful to empower them in a sense and demystify what it really is about mm-hmm. and make them see that it's not about dudes going out drinking together in the woods and telling dirty jokes. You know, it's about sort of...
I mean, you can still do that.
You can if you want. If that's your thing, fine. But I think as far as hunting and eating goes, I think, you know, it closes the circle. It's not just about going to the supermarket and getting a boneless, skinless, styrofoam-wrapped piece of chicken mm-hmm. that doesn't look like it was ever a living thing. And it's emotional for a lot of them. It's an emotional, intense moment, but it's a very life-changing experience, too.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Do people cry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always emotional for me every time, no matter what. It's almost a spiritual thing. And the Native Americans actually used to eat the warm heart as a way to inherit the spirit of the animal. And it was a very and it's an important thing, I think, in a way, to have that experience because you respect it more and you take it seriously.
And that sort of reverence, I think, is something that people who perhaps haven't hunted themselves or maybe have some harebrained criticism of it, they don't understand.
Sure.
Or they've never witnessed. Because, I mean, I grew up with a hunting family and I grew up with many people in our... I mean, my paternal grandfather was raised in the mountains with the dirt floor, and everything he ate, he had killed himself. Sure. And we've had long conversations about this during bouts of my own vegetarianism for, you know, a myriad of reasons. And in the end, we agree on it because I remember he had said to me, you know, I started hunting when I was a kid, and I had the mentality of a child, and I knew that I was ending the life of something, but I also knew I was feeding my 9 siblings, and that was more beautiful. Mm. And, you know, his mother taught him to thank the animal.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, it sounds like what you're talking about, which is so cool.
Absolutely. You have a tremendous reverence and respect for the animal, and you also use every part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, so much gets wasted in our modern system and our feedlot system where the animals are tortured and stuffed corn. And it's just to be able to go around that whole process and really have a way to be more thrifty and economical and respectful from the field and the woods to the plate is really an important and powerful experience.
Absolutely. And I hope more people approach it. And I do think that not necessarily hunting, but the like learning how to butcher sure. animals yourself, and maybe hunting is becoming kind of more of the trend and just getting, I mean, obviously getting close to what you eat has been a trend for a while with
sure.
sustainable organic. But I really hope that people like you help to open other people's minds.
Yeah, thanks, me too. I think, you know, it's hunting, not everyone's going to be able to go and hunt, but I think that there are sure. small ways that you can, you know, whether it's going to a farm and participating, you know, buying a share of an animal with friends and you know, going and participating in the butchering or the slaughter. You know, I think that's a meaningful life experience to have as a human being who chooses to eat meat. You know, if mm-hmm. you choose to eat it, to be able to sort of participate in even some small part of that process, I think is life-changing.
Absolutely.
So what's your next endeavor? What are you working on right now?
I just actually submitted my next book a couple days ago. It's sort of a lifestyle guide. I think my editor is calling it The Fearless Girl's Guide to Self-Sufficiency and Survival. And it's sort of a combination of how to be thrifty, you know, how to take after a party all those bottles of red wine that have a little bit in it, and how to sort of save those and turn them into red wine popsicles, or sort of these more lifestyle skills, like how to find your way without a compass, you know, or, mm-hmm. or with a compass, or how to change a tire. So things that maybe our grandmother knew how to do, but we've kind of forgotten about. So it's a hybrid recipes/lifestyle skills. So it comes out next year.
Fantastic. And where can people get more information about you, learn about Girl Hunter Weekends and your new book?
Yeah. My book is actually coming out in paperback next week, I believe, Girl Hunter. My website is just my name, georgiapellegrini.com. And all my Girl Hunter Weekends are always announced on there. And we do them a couple times a year, and they're hugely successful and a wonderful sort of girl bonding, girl power weekend. So it's been a real pleasure to meet those women.
Thank you for so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back on The Morning After with Camille Riviere.
This one's called Kill Me in the Summertime by Dead Stars on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
We all know what a foodie is, but what's foodiness? Foodiness is turning us into those chubby, slushy, slurping, lounge chair-bound morons in WALL-E. Plugged in, pumped full of sugar, and brain dead.
Chef Erica Wides is here to fight against foodiness.
You have to keep drinking the Let's Get Real Kool-Aid for it to start to work.
Let's Get Real. Rediscover real food every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on The Morning After. In studio, Camille Riviere and her partner in crime, Fleur, or in the U.S., we call her Flower. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Thank you.
So, Camille, you lived and worked in New York City in the wine world for how long?
I think I came here when I was 23 or 22 years old, after being in hotel management school in France. I was a chef in England, a food and beverage assistant manager in a four-star hotel dressed like a penguin. And I knew that in France, young women with no parents in the wine industry, there are very little chance of me having a fun, interesting, and challenging job. So I made sure that my last internship coming out of school was going to be in New York. And I worked for Peter Morel for about 2 years, purchasing Bordeaux, selling all of the 2003 big campaign. And then I moved on to a distributor, Frederick Wildman, for 5 years, 3 months, 2 weeks, few hours. And it was a great experience. Yes. It was a good experience. And but at some point, women, we turned 30, and there was, I would say, I don't know, there's a change in, I needed a change in my life. There was hormones exploding, going in every direction, and I knew I needed to go back to my roots. So I said thank you to Wildman, and it wasn't easy. It took me a year, because I thought that when you leave New York, everything around doesn't exist. Like, how am I going to do to leave the city where there's the most wine brought to, the most exciting, all those restaurants, the scene, the Psalms. It's really a happening city. But I knew it wasn't for, I would maybe come back, but I need to go back into the vineyards in France and to look for my next step. And so I decided, my grandpa's American, my father's French, my mom's American, and my American grandpa, he did Omaha Beach, and so I decided to go back on June 6th in France as a little symbol. And 2 days later, when I was at my beach house in Brittany, I was confronted to that one bottle of wine, Le Clos Fontaine, and that kind of changed the game. So I'm like, what is that wine about? I didn't really used to, for now my company that I have, it's more about sourcing natural wines. Mm-hmm. Even though there's not really a definition for those wines, it's basically wines that are made just with grapes and using indigenous yeast, not adding sugar, not adding acid. It's really basically bringing what the fruit, what the earth tells you, into a bottle of wine. And so I need to go and visit those girls. And they were in the Languedoc. And from there on, I did like a 3 months trip all around the Languedoc. It was not my favorite region at all. There was a lot of those wines, they're usually super alcoholic, big. And but those were really seductive and really pretty. And not far from the Clos Fontaine, there's that other guy who was my teacher in hotel management school called Jean-François Couteloup, Mas Couteloup. And he made some really democratic, fun, delicious wines. And when I came back in September, so 4 months after moving from New York to Paris, I came back for the wedding of a girlfriend and offered some of those wines and tasted them with some of my former customers. And they're like, Camille, when are those wines in? And so basically it's my customers who challenged me to start this import company. And since then, each time I come in, they're like, Camille, what's new? So I can't be able to come back to New York without new wines, otherwise they'll kick my ass.
Well, and you also left Wildman with a pretty high profile client.
It was really difficult to leave a delicious six digit job, basically, that I can conduct from my bed, even being high and smoking, just working 2 hours a day. But at the end, you know, when you're 30 and you're no longer challenged like this, you have to make a life change. It wasn't easy. For 2 years, I'm not going to take a paycheck on my company. I just reinvest everything in stocks because I want to stay independent and not have someone coming in and telling me, well, maybe we should get, some high-yielding wines in order to be able to make more money. I just really want to keep the integrity, the democratic approach to searching wine, and to be able to find wines that you can bring back and put in a shop, and it can be under below $20 on a shelf, and people can enjoy real wine and have a good experience.
I mean, because you could choose to hook up with a distributor, and you know they could rep your wine. Right?
Yeah, but that would take away the fun of coming to New York, seeing the friends, telling the stories, mm-hmm. and I'd feel hard because all those wines. It's so many hours on the roads. Just this fall, I did 5,000 kilometers with my friend Flower. We were in Loire, Cahors, Gaillac, Toulouse, Languedoc, Jura, Coteau du Génois, Alsace. Enfin, it's basically a lot of time on the road. It's not always that glamorous. It can be humid. It could be raining. We can be in that tiny little bed. But it's always fun, and the people we meet are extremely generous of their time. And to me, I feel richer working in that environment than I was when I had a super comfortable apartment in New York and a really nice paycheck, too.
Fleur, how did you get involved with Camille and going wine hunting with her?
Well, I've been working for several years in Paris, distributing wine to restaurants, and she just popped in one of those reunions we have on Monday with the vin en tête, and I was like, "Who's that girl? She's so energetic. I wanna know more." Mm-hmm. So I just took a chance to go for a first wine hunting. She just invited people who didn't know each other, so it was fun. It was a big risk, but the magic worked. And mm-hmm. And since it's been 1 year of marvelous, new tastings and new winemakers, and it's not always a success, so mm-hmm. we can lose time, we can go for nothing in a place, but you always get to understand things better and go deeper in the whole perception of the wine, natural winemaking.
Yeah, and Fleur, if I may say, for example, for every winery I bring in, we had to go through at least 100 that were kind of bouncy or crappy or weird. So we really like weed out all of the stuff and do a lot of work to bring back the essential and the purity. In the job I do, a lot of importers, and I'm not saying bad stuff about other importers, but they don't have the advantage I have of being on the grounds in France. I come to New York every 2-3 months, but most of the time I live in France. And so it's not about going to that famous wine shop or that famous wine bar, looking at what's on the shelf and say, okay, let's call the winemakers, make an appointment, and get the labels and the process going. It's really about going deep, like going to those wine tasting, talking to a winemaker, he'll reference another guy. It's not always it's a lot of work in kilometers, but there's always a good meeting or an interesting story that happens. For example, in December we went in Alsace, and we had booked like 3 appointments. You know, we thought we're good, and before going to Alsace, we're in the Jura hanging out with the guys from L'Octavin. It's a property in the Jura that one of my friends, Zev, another importer, brings in. They're really awesome, good wines. Check them out.
Zevrovine.
Yep.
We know Zev.
And salut, Zev. And basically, those people told us, no, Camille, you should check out that other domain called Domaine Banvart. I'm like, all right. And that was the only domain that was not on our original route that another winemaker had told us about, and that was the strike. So you never know what you're going out to see. It's always an experience.
How are you approached? Because you're a woman coming in trying to buy their wine. I mean, I know you work with female winemakers, but there's also male winemakers mm-hmm. who are stubborn. And I feel like you've told me a couple stories where you know they expect some like broody kind of man, and here you show up.
I'm definitely not the profile of the typical wine buyer, even in France. Not because I go to each wine fair, like there's often a lot of trade shows all around France, natural trade shows. So now they kind of like, oh, Camille, la chasseuse de vin. So that's the name of the wine hunter out there. And now they kind of know me, and we feel more comfortable, but they definitely don't expect to see younger women. But we're serious, and we take their work really seriously, and we give them the time they need, make them comfortable. It's not really an issue, you know. It's basically you get a reputation pretty quickly. It's not a very large world, you know. People know each other, And they know, like, oh, yeah, she's serious. She sells the wine of Stéphane Tissot. She pays the wine before they leave the domain. And so they know it's sound and it's and it'll work well. And it's kind of rewarding for them. You know, when we're in New York, take pictures of their bottles in Times Square, send it to them. They're like, wow, no, my wine's in New York. It's kind of cool. Even though they won't tell you that all the time. But I think they like the attentions.
So where can people who are listening check out your wine, find your wine? They can they buy it directly from you, or is it more kind of in restaurants where it's being sold?
Well, I do buy, for example, the entire chain. I buy the wine, and then I have it shipped to the U.S. and I'm the importer and the distributor, and so I go and see buyers in restaurants, sommeliers, and also retail stores. The retail stores have been really nice and supportive. Ledoux, Astor, Chambers, Uva, Flatiron. A lot of people have been really excited, and Fermented Grapes also is another one. So I make sure that it's in restaurants and that you can also have it in retail stores. So if you can check it out in a restaurant and you liked it, you could still have it somewhere else.
Thank you so much for being here. When do you guys head back?
Next Sunday, and then it's directly out to the Dive and in the Loire Valley for another session of Chasse au Vin.
Château de Brézé. Under the snow. I was told it would be minus 15 degrees in here. I don't know what's the equivalent in Fahrenheit, but
it's cold.
No, well, right now it's just like spring. So we're going to get a bit of winter in Saumur.
I'm so sorry. Can I please come wine hunting with you guys one day?
Oh, yeah, please.
Sure,
do.
Welcome.
Please
welcome.
Do. All right. I'm going to. We'll bring Zev along, but that was recorded on air. Everyone heard that. So we're going to take a break on The Morning After. We'll be back with what's on the menu at Chardonnay's.
You're listening to I Get By Dead Stars on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to The Morning After. It's time for what's on the menu at Chardonnay's.
What's on the menu at Chardonnay's?
Chardonnay's is our mythical restaurant that celebrates all bad food and wine trends, even decor trends.
That is something that we need to talk about, is decor trends, at another time. Maybe we'll get Curtis in here. We'll talk about bad architectural trends from the 90s.
Curtis is the host of Burning Down the House, which is the show that follows us. So, you know, what's on the menu at Chardonnay is Chardonnay is a French grape. I have to ask Camille and Fleur, you know, is there a Chardonnay's in France?
What's on the menu at Chardonnay's?
I think there might be Chardonnays. Fleur, could you talk about the Chardonnays?
I would say that as much as I've understood the Chardonnay style, I would pick
the style.
Hippopotamus, which is like this kind of very crap meat restaurant. You can go whatever the hour is, the time is. So you could bunch in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there'll still be these. Actually, the customers, they look like hippopotamus. they have children, plenty of children, who put their finger in their nose and scratch their ass and shout for more.
Sounds like Roberta's.
And the meat is always overcooked, and everything's like frost or out of cans. And it's the only good thing is that it's pretty democratic. It's not very expensive, so you could go whatever the time is and for a small budget. But apart from that, I mean, there's absolutely no interest but a social study of hippopotamus.
So there is a French Chardonnay,
and it's called Hippopotamus.
And we are going there.
We are totally going there. Georgia, is there a like what's on the menu at Chardonnay's live game
in the hunter world? Mm-hmm. Probably pheasant that's been cooked for too many hours in cream of mushroom soup from a can. Maybe some venison that's wrapped in bacon and stuffed with cream cheese and jalapenos. I think cream cheese and jalapenos and cream of mushroom soup are the stars of the Chardonnays
now, are
of
those
the hunting world.
Jalapenos fresh or canned?
Oh, canned. Oh,
okay, yeah. Great.
I mean,
great.
Come on, who are we kidding?
I got worried for a second.
Let's not get overboard here.
Thank you all so much for being on the
Thank
show.
Thank you, ladies.
Camille,
Thank you.
Georgia, Fleur.
My pleasure.
Jen, of course.
Jesse, Jesus, everybody.
We'll be back here next week on The Morning After.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.